This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The White House published new estimates on Friday that showed slower than expected economic growth and interest rates. It also expected the government's deficit to rise. In the years after the Great Recession hit in 2008, economic forecasts have struggled to make sense of why corporate profits are up but wages have remained stagnant. Today, we turn to British Marxist economist Michael Roberts, who has examined aggregate empirical economic data and determined that the world economy is in a long depression. Michael Roberts worked as an economist for over 30 years in the City of London Financial Center. He is the author of The Great Recession, A Marxist View, and his new book is called The Long Depression, How It Happened, Why It Happened, and What Happens Next. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let's talk about history first so that we can set a backdrop for what we are seeing happening today. A lot of economists look at the recession that began in 2008 as a recession simply because our last framework, a historical framework for an economic, massive economic slump, although we've had smaller slumps, was the Great Depression of the 1930s. And we can say, well, what we're going through right now is not nearly as bad as what happened back then. You know, people were starving in the streets. And so what we have now is a recession, not a depression. But you think of it as a long depression. Explain that.
Well, as you say, Sonali, there have been a lot of recessions or slumps over the past, 150 years in the development of industrial capitalist economies. The National Bureau of Economic Research in the US reckons there's been 33 in the US alone over that period. And there's been quite a few in the post-war period, but they usually recover after 2 or 3 years. People lose their jobs, they lose their incomes, but eventually the economy recovers and they start to get their jobs back and so on. But this time, since 2009, at the end of this big slump that we had in that year and the big crash in the banking sector, and then the housing market, things have not recovered very fast at all. The United States has had the best recovery, and it's been very weak indeed. And then the rest of the major economies of the world, it's been much worse. I just saw a figure, Sonali, from McKinsey, the American management consultants, this week, which said that two-thirds of households in the 25 top countries of the world have suffered a loss in real income since 2005. Two-thirds, they haven't recovered to the previous level. That shows, in my view, how weak this so-called recovery has been. That's different from previous recessions. That's why I call it a long depression, similar to that we saw in the 1930s or in the late 19th century in the 1880s and 1890s in the US.
Right, you talk about that recession or depression that went before the Great Depression. In fact, are there more similarities between what happened in the late 1800s and what we're seeing now?
Yes, I think it's a close analogy. There we saw a decline in the rate of growth and incomes for ordinary people and in the economy. We saw a much higher level of unemployment and prices dropping below zero, even deflating, which a lot of people might say, well, that's good news, price is falling, but it's also bad news for those who have got a lot of debts and find it difficult to pay. And that period in the 1880s and 1890s in the UK and the US, which were the two big economies then, lasted from nearly 20 years with a series of successive slumps. And in some ways, I have a worry that we're in that sort of period now where you could see since 2009, we've now, it's nearly 7 years, and we're still, many countries are still below where they were then in 2007. And most of the, as I say, most households have not recovered to where they were before. And we're, and I have to say, Sonali, I think there's a real possibility that we could have another global recession in the next year or two, given the state of slowdown in investment and in profitability, which was high but is now collapsing quite fast around the major economies.
So let's talk about the data and why it is that most mainstream economists are unable to or seem unable to predict these slumps and recessions. Is it that they're sort of only looking at small pieces of data and one-off instances rather than, as you do in your book, looking at aggregate economic data?
Well, I think that might be part of it. I remember the famous story is when the in the height or the depth of the slump in 2008, the Queen of England went to a meeting of top economists in London and asked them, why are we in this mess? And they looked blankly at her, not having an answer. And in fact, most of the mainstream economists around the world have failed to explain how we got into this big slump, why there's been such a weak recovery, and what's going to happen next, which is what my book is about exactly. Earlier this year, I was in San Francisco, California, which is the annual conference of the American Economics Association. And all the top economists of the world were there debating these issues and still not really able to explain why there hasn't been a recovery. In my view, and the book tries to explain this to hopefully readers and your viewers, that the key thing in any economy is how well investment is growing, particularly in the business sector. If businesses are not investing, people don't get jobs, they don't get a better incomes, and there's not enough spending. And the reason businesses may not invest is if they don't make profits or sufficient profits. That's the key in a capitalist economy. You could have different economies, but in the capitalist economy, profits is what matters. And at the moment, we've seen quite a significant weakening in the profitability of capital. We hear a lot about big profits being held by the big companies like Apple, Microsoft, and so on. But the broad swathe of capitalist companies across the world are really struggling to raise their profitability, and so they're not investing. And if they don't invest, then we get a slowdown, productivity falls, people don't get decent jobs, they may get poor jobs, poorly paid jobs, but not decent ones, and the economies don't recover. That's the depressive nature of the current situation, and none of the mainstream economists seem to grasp this.
So we cannot measure the health of our economy by the profitability of the few big corporations that are managing through various means to do well. And then is the reason why, in general, wages are depressed, is that because the lesser than big corporations, the sort of middle of the road corporations are all struggling?
Well, that's part of the reason. Over the past 30 years, if I try to look in the book, try to measure the profitability of all the companies in the major economies, that's the way that I start to try to analyze what's going on. And what we saw a peak in profitability in the 1960s, a long time ago when I was young. But then we had a period of 20 years when profitability in all the major capitalist economies and companies collapsed down to the lower 80s. So there was a big struggle amongst the companies and their governments to try and raise profitability. And they tried to do that by holding down wages, destroying the ability of workers to organize to protect their wages, on trade unions and so on, sending investment abroad to low-wage countries around the world, so-called globalization, privatizing state sectors that might have provided jobs and investment, and generally trying to raise the profitability of capital, which they managed, Sonali, a little bit, but it's still way lower than it was in the 60s. So every time we enter another slump, for whatever reason, whether it's a banking crash or a housing market crash, profitability is still too low, debt is still too high, and capitalism starts to struggle really badly. And it's now really struggling to get out of this rut that it's in at the moment.
And Michael, can you explain Marx's theory of how capitalism and profitability works and why the data that you found matches that theory better than mainstream economic models?
Yes, I think if the viewers were trying to think, what is the key thing in a capitalist economy? It's trying to expand an economy. We all want more things. We need better services. We need more incomes to spend and so on. How do we get that? We get that through an economy investing more and trying to provide extra employment using the new technology, making more things more cheaply and quicker for us to use. Raising productivity is the economic phrase. Now, the problem with capitalism is that capitalism doesn't do it for people's needs. Capitalists only invest, that's the big companies and their boards of directors and the banks, if the profit goes to the company. So profitability is the key. And profitability, according to Marx, comes into conflict with what we need. It's not harmonious. Mainstream economists will say, more profit, more investment, better growth. And no, no, not necessarily, because more profit doesn't continue indefinitely. There's a tendency for profitability to decline as capitalists try to expand technology and reduce the amount of labor they have. And in the book, I explain how that works more in more detail. As a result, profitability comes into conflict with what people need and the need to produce more to meet the growing population and raise our living standards. And that conflict continually arises and is only resolved briefly by a series of slumps, one after the other. So slumps are a product of trying to recreate profitability for the capitalists at the expense of the rest of us.
So essentially what you're saying is that in order for the economy, since we, you know, if we accept that this is the economic model we're going to live with, in order for the economy to keep expanding, we've got to have slumps, which means ordinary people have got to suffer in order for longer term profitability of corporations.
Well, if you take the rational logic of capitalism, that's what it means. Mm. There are a number of economists who actually think that's the way it is, and you just have to accept that. That's capitalism. These are the more, what you might call the more conservative economists who say, just accept this. The more liberal economists say, no, we've got to change that. That's not good news. Inequality is too high of wealth and income. There's too much regular slumps. We need to deal with that. In the 1930s, a British more liberal economist called John Maynard Keynes said we have to deal with this problem and we need to spend more. The government needs to spend more when there's a slump to get us out of a slump and not just accept the situation. Unfortunately, the solutions that Keynes came up with and are still adopted by more liberal economists also don't seem to work. And I think in the book I say, look, in this long depression, Keynesian type policies, these liberal policies, are not working because the capitalist system really depends on profitability, and the Keynesian solutions don't deliver that. So there is, you could end the discussion by saying, well, it's not a question of trying to make capitalism work or just accepting the slumps. Perhaps we need to discuss how we could have a better social organization for human beings, which produce things for people that they need collectively and democratically control, which we don't have.
I want to ask you about that, because of course that's the better conversation to have. The system isn't working. What can we replace it with? But just to focus, you mentioned liberal economists don't tend to be able to see this view. You open your book in your introduction with a quote by Paul Krugman, one of our great liberal economists here in the United States, and he even looks at this great recession that we're in as a long depression. But does he get it? I mean, does he get that the current system is built on necessary slumps and recessions for profitability?
Well, I don't think he does, Sonali. In that quote, I say that Paul Krugman says, we seem to be in a long depression. And a few years ago, he wrote a book called End Depression Now, with an exclamation mark, saying, yes, we need to sort this out. We need to end the depression. But if your viewers ever read his book, it's a little shorter than mine, you'll find that he doesn't explain how we ever got into this depression, into these slumps. And he doesn't really explain how we would avoid the next one, because even the Keynesian liberal economists want to get things better, but they don't really have a solution or a policy that can achieve it. So you're left with the alternative of the conservative economists who say there's nothing you can do, just accept this situation.
Hmm. What about some of the other economists and economic theorists that we have had today? I'm thinking of Thomas Piketty, the French economist who also, like you, looked at long-term data to analyze, you know, trends over decades to show that capitalism basically is kind of a by design flawed system. What do you make of his analysis?
Thomas Piketty, if your viewers ever get to read it, it's a very long book. It's 750 pages, and I think it's now regarded as the most well-sold and bought book that people haven't read in the last year, because it's a hard going. But the gist of it, I can tell your viewers, is that what Thomas Piketty is telling us is there's been a huge increase in the inequality of income and wealth around the world, particularly in the United States and the UK, particularly in the post-war period, and that we're really back to the levels of inequality we haven't seen since the 19th century. And that's the situation we're in.
So let's talk about what, the sort of longer view. I think the downfalls, the pitfalls of capitalism seem more apparent to people now more than ever, simply partly because we have a lot of data to be able to examine, and also because we have better means of communication with one another. And people see the effects in their own lives. So if there was ever a moment that capitalism globally was in trouble, now might be it. Are there models that you can point to worldwide that have worked well, that either have a regulated capitalism or a complete alternative to capitalism that works for people rather than for profits?
Well, yes, I think the solutions of a regulated capitalism, or making capitalism fairer or more equal, or trying to manage it better, many of these policies have been adopted over the last 30 or 40 years, and even longer than that, and they haven't succeeded. So I think your viewers need to look at what will be an alternative to capitalism. We've got, are you okay there? Can you
yes,
hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Yes, keep talking.
Yeah. We've got I think your viewers should be aware, and I explained in the book, there are three big challenges coming up for the human race over the next 30 to 40 years. The first is the growing problem of climate change and global warming. And at the moment, our capitalist system around the world and its governments are doing little or nothing about that. And we face a serious situation for many people around the world of flooding, earthquakes, and other things that will arise from the climate change. And that is something that's got to be dealt with. Secondly, we have growing automation, the introduction of robots and artificial intelligence. Are we going to have a world where just a small number of people control these robots and artificial intelligence, and the rest of us are left close to destitution because we're no longer needed to work? How will we organize a society that really can be where the economic things can be run by robots and artificial intelligence? Can we use that to increase our leisure time and to use our time more productively, or will it turn into more inequality? The third thing that's been happening, as you described, we discussed before with Thomas Piketty, the rising inequality in income that's throughout the world, particularly in the major capitalist economies. Those are three challenges which I discuss in the book. And I think it poses the question of having an alternative way of organizing our society than the current one.
Interestingly enough, we recently spoke with Andy Stern, who used to be the head of one of the biggest unions in the United States, and he took on this challenge of how technology is actually driving down wages, which makes a case for a universal basic income. But again, that's a tweaking to the capitalist system. How would you describe to a layperson a remaking of an economic model? Because, we are told by the Margaret Thatchers of the world, there is no alternative.
Well, I think there is an alternative. It's people have to discuss and analyze the nature of the problems now and think about an alternative. What would be more logical is for people to organize all the resources of the world, all the technology of the world, all the human skills of the world in a collective way, not to allow just a small group of people to own and control the means of production and the services around the world, and for governments just to support them and to fight in wars against each other, but to come together collectively to organize through common ownership of all the means of production and services to produce what people need. We can start that in the countries that really matter, like America, Britain, and Europe, and so on, and start that process. And that means looking for alternatives and perhaps organizing politically and other ways to put forward the view that there is an alternative. We've had a sort of discussion like that in America during the
Democratic and Republican primaries, and we've had a similar discussion developing in parts of Europe. That's going to continue, I think.
And so, by the way, what do you make of the way in which a candidate like Bernie Sanders has gotten so much traction in the United States, a man who, you know, calls himself a democratic socialist, notwithstanding the fact that he has now stepped back and endorsed the neoliberal candidate in the race, but still just the way in which he inspired so much popular traction?
Yes, well, I think what Bernie Sanders has demonstrates and represents the great increase in the number of American people are looking for an alternative to the way things have been run over the last in their lifetimes. They realize that's not working. They're looking for something better, for something that will really work, that can change ordinary people's lives. And that Bernie Sanders seemed to represent that. We're getting a similar phenomenon in the UK with the coming to the leadership of the opposition Labour Party with Jeremy Corbyn, who stands for a more populist left-wing view, looking for better for the things that are better for ordinary people rather than for the rich and wealthy. And we see some of those movements in Europe. So I think that's what it represents.
My guest has been Michael Roberts. He worked as an economist for over 30 years in the City of London's Financial Center, and he is author of The Great Recession, A Marxist View. His new book that we've been discussing is called The Long Depression: How It Happened, Why It Happened, and What Happens Next. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.